roar inside, the thunder of uncertainty. The voices reminding you every day of your failures, that you're just not good enough. You're frustrated. You've been told it's over. You are who you are, and what's done is done. But you weren't created to be average. There's greatness in you. Now get up and take it. Your past is there, reminding you that you just can't do it. But pick yourself up, dust yourself off. It's time to get up and fight. You've been beat up, beaten down, head hanging, heart pounding. You're tired, but greatness is calling to be what you were made to be. Now get up and fight.
All right, how's everybody doing today? Good, good to see you. So good to be with all of you, and want to welcome all of our guests and first-time visitors. Man, we're thrilled that you're here, and we'd love to give a great big shout-out to each and every one of our campuses. So North, Downtown, West, all of you online, those of you here at our Northwest campus, hearing great reports this morning as to what God is doing around each one of our campuses. So glad to have you. And if you've been here last weekend, PD got us kicked off on a great four-part series of messages that we are currently in with a bit of an ominous title, I realize, called The Fight of Your Life. I'm ashamed to admit this, but I've only been in one fist fight in my entire life. And let me be clear, I'm ashamed that I've been in a fist fight, not that it's only been one, all right? It was actually my ninth grade year in high school, and it was with one of my very best friends. His name is David. David lived down the street from me. And we had been really close, like in middle school and junior high, but our ninth grade year of high school, we started to drift apart, and it's not uncommon in adolescence. I can't even tell you all the reasons why. It was just happening. And because of that, it created some tension in our friendship. And one afternoon, we were in David's backyard. A whole bunch of neighborhood boys got together. And we were playing backyard football, but it was full-on contact tackle football, which, looking back on it, probably wasn't the wisest decision. And David was guarding me, and the tension sort of boiled over between the two of us. And he looked at me, and he called me a name, which made me mad. So I said something about his mom that I can't repeat to you today, but it was a good one. And then David comes running at me and, like, blindsides me with a haymaker to my right eye. And it was on, right? Like, all the neighborhood boys circled up. They were like, whoa, you know, fight, fight, fight. And David and I are kind of circling each other, kind of doing this little thing. And the whole fight lasted maybe 60 seconds or less. A few more punches were thrown. None of them landed. And it's pretty safe to say that I have zero future in the UFC. And I walked away out of that backyard with a wounded pride and a black eye. And I remember walking home. My mom was in the kitchen making dinner that night, and I didn't want her to see my face, and she saw my black eye, and she freaked out. She was just like, "What happened to your eye?" And I said, "Well, I got into a fist fight." And man, she really panicked. She said, "With who?" And I think she was thinking there was maybe like a new kid that moved into the neighborhood or something. When I told her David, she was really beside herself because he had been one of my very good friends. I mean, David had been over to our house a lot. So after dinner, she and my dad called David's parents. They just lived down the street from us. They invited them over, to my dismay. And I remember they, like, rang the doorbell, and David and his mom and dad walked in, and we couldn't even look at each other. And we sat down in the living room, and our parents made us sit there until we talked it out. And it was excruciating. And looking back on it, it actually took more courage and more energy for David and I to have the conversation than it did for us to have a fist fight. And you know, that's usually the case. When it comes to the people that we love and care for in our lives, and maybe there's some tension or there's a disagreement of some kind, it's easier to maybe write that other person off or to throw a few verbal attacks than it is to actually fight for the relationship. And so this is true in what we talked about last weekend with marriage. It's going to be true in what we're going to talk about next weekend with friendship. But it's also true in what we want to talk about today when it comes to parenting, or I want to actually broaden that out a little bit, the parent-child relationship and the child-parent dynamic, regardless of how old you are. Now, I just want to go ahead and say that I realize that not everybody in the room right now listening to this is a parent. Some of you may not see yourself as ever being a parent. Maybe you really want to be a parent, and for whatever reason, that just hasn't happened for you. And I just want to acknowledge that Not everybody's in the same position. So you hear like a sermon on parenting, and it's easy maybe to want to write it off. And I just want you to know that you more than likely had two people that brought you into the world. And so this relates to us, and maybe there's going to be some nieces and nephews or some young people in your life. God is your Heavenly Father. And so there's some things that we want to talk about today that apply to all of us, regardless of who we are. But I do want to speak specifically to parents and kids in the room. And this dynamic is unique. It's a blessing, and it's presented with a whole bunch of challenges. For starters, as parents, you don't get to pick the personality of your kids. And sometimes you wish you could, right? Like, it's like if I could just have a website, www.buildyourownkid.com, type in all the characteristics that I would like for them to have, and then, you know, out they come. But that's just not the case. They're so unique, so different. My wife, Lindsay, and I, we have four kids, and they're great kids. I mean, we have a boy and three girls, 15, 13, 11, and 6, and they're just amazing. And, you know, all the time I have people that come up to me, and they're like, hey, I just met your daughter today, man. You can tell she's a Brocket. You know, you just kind of, you're around them not very long. You know they all came from the same litter. But there's some uniquenesses to each one of them. It blows my mind as a dad to see that we're raising four kids under the same roof with the same set of values. Many of them have the same experiences. And yet what works for one doesn't necessarily work for the other. It definitely keeps you on your toes. Parenting is not one size fits all. We've got to tailor it to each particular child. Now, to be fair, they didn't get to pick us either. Right, and so yeah, as parents, we maybe have personality traits that maybe our kids have to endure as well. The whole point is that when it comes to who your parents are or who your kids become, much of the time we just don't have a say in it. And this can be presents a whole bunch of challenges, especially to those of you who are maybe new parents right now. Statistically speaking, 56% of parents say that they lack confidence to be one. 71% of parents struggle to find time to enjoy activities with their kids. 80% wanted to find out more information on how to improve their relationship with their children. George Barna, who's a statistician, said this. He said, 62% of parents we interviewed define successful parenting as having done the best they could regardless of the outcomes, which I guess is okay. But your kids aren't a casserole, all right? I mean, it's like, well, we'll just see how this turns out, all right? I mean, and it kind of reminds me of what some of these celebrities have said about parenting. Michelle Pfeiffer says, like all parents, my husband and I just do the best we can, hold our breath, and hope we've set aside enough money for our kids' therapy. Jim Gaffigan said, sometimes I feel unqualified to be a parent. I call those times being awake. And I can relate to all of that. And I just want to acknowledge, maybe there's some of you in the room, maybe you're grown adults, and, you know, you just had fantastic parents. And maybe your parents are no longer in the picture, maybe they've passed away, but maybe you look at that and you go, man, I'm so thankful for my mom and my dad, and they made some sacrifices, and they gave us opportunities, they really introduced us to Jesus. Man, if that's your story, you know, you shouldn't feel bad about that. We want to celebrate that with you. It's amazing. And some of you right now that you have kids, you're just loving the whole process. Psalm 127, verse 3 says, children are a blessing and a gift from God. And so we celebrate that with you. But I also know that this particular subject comes with a whole lot of potential mines that we can step on. I know that there's a lot of emotional pain as it comes to this particular subject. It's interesting to me that the people that can oftentimes cause us the greatest emotional amount of pain in our lives can be the two people that either brought us into the world or the people that we bring into it. So I don't know if any of these statements you can identify with any of them or not, but maybe some of you had a mom or a dad that growing up they just were not emotionally available to you. Maybe you have a child right now that requires so much from you but just is not able to give anything back. Maybe your parents abandoned you or they hurt you. Maybe your kids demand more than you can provide. Maybe you don't talk to your parents much anymore since you moved out and since that disagreement where some really hurtful words were spoken that can never be taken back. Maybe you couldn't make time for your kids when they were younger, and now that they are older, they aren't willing or able to make much time for you. Maybe your parents are aging right now. They're getting older and time feels like it's running out. There's some things that you really need to say and you're trying to muster up the courage to say them. Maybe your teenager right now is rebelling, they say some incredibly hurtful things, you just have a very difficult time identifying with them in any way or finding common ground. Maybe your parents don't approve of your spouse or the choices that you're now making as an adult. Maybe your kids make fun of the clothes that you wear. Maybe your dad, no matter how much you ask him to, he just keeps bringing up his political views at the Thanksgiving meal and just embarrasses you every year. Maybe your 30-year-old son still lives in your basement. And if he's here today, don't look at him, all right? Maybe your parents, after 25 years of marriage, and you thought was actually a happy marriage, they call you in your college dorm to tell you that they're getting a divorce. Maybe your teenage daughter comes home to tell you that she's pregnant. Maybe your mother still makes you feel like a helpless little girl, even though you're 35 years old with a family and a career of your own. Maybe your grown child gets into trouble with the law again, and you have a hard time figuring out, should you let them face those consequences or should you bail them out? I don't know if any of you can relate to any of those statements, but if you can, then you're in good company with King David. And as Petey said last week, if your impression of all the people in the Bible is that they had it all together and that they're perfect, you need to look at King David's story, because he made some significant mistakes in his life. And yet that's one of the reasons why I really love David so much, is because he made these huge blunders. He had these moments of greatness, moments where he was faithful, but then other moments where he wasn't. And yet he's still described as a man after God's own heart. And that gives me great hope in my life, because I have great intentions. I want to be faithful. I want to do what God asks me to do. And yet I can identify with Paul when I say, sometimes the things that I don't want to do, these I keep on doing. And God says, man, my grace is enough to cover you, and I can actually redeem any bad decision that you make. And in 1 Kings chapter 2, if you have a Bible or a Bible app, I want to encourage you maybe to meet me there in it. If you don't have one, I will put the passages that we're going to walk through together on the monitor beside me. But let me just give you a little bit of context for what we're getting ready to read together. David is an old man at this particular point. He is on his deathbed, so to speak, and he summons one of his kids in to come to see him. Now, he's got more than one, which is interesting to me that he only asked one of them to come see him. I don't know if that says anything at all about the relationship that he had with the others. But David is there on his deathbed. He's got some things he wants to say to his son, Solomon. And what David says reveals a lot about the kind of dad that he was, both the good and the bad. Let's start with the good. Beginning in verse 2, David says to Solomon, I'm going where everyone on earth must someday go, so take courage and be a man. Observe the requirements of the Lord your God and follow all of his ways. Keep the decrees, the commands, the regulations and laws written in the law of Moses, so that you will be successful in all you do and wherever you go. If you do this, then the Lord will keep the promise he made to me. He told me, now this is in quotes, so this is a reference to something that God said to David a long time ago. It's actually, you can read it in Psalm 132. God says to David, if your descendants, your kids, live as they should and follow me faithfully with all of their heart and soul, one of them will always sit on the throne of Israel. Now, so far in this particular talk, this sounds like a pretty good father-son deathbed conversation. If they were to make a movie about this, I could totally see Denzel Washington being cast into the role of David, can't you? Just Denzel saying, doing that thing that he does, you know, where he says something so powerfully, take courage and be a man. That's the best Denzel I have. I know, that's really sorry. I apologize. It's pretty good, right? He's given his son some last-minute counsel before he passes away, and then he kind of throws this last little statement in at the very end of verse 4. He's like, hey, you know, God said this to me a long time ago. He said that if my kids would follow after me, then one of them would always sit on the throne. And I can't help but think that David throws this in because he's still holding on to hope that this is going to happen, but he's wondering if it will. Not because God can't be depended upon, because David wasn't very dependable as a father. And he knows that time is running out, and so he's trying to speak to this particular issue. And there appears to be, if you know anything at all about David's story, kind of a veiled desperation here in verse 4. It's almost as if he is saying to Solomon, Solomon, you're my last hope here. The other kids aren't here. They won't talk to me. Right? I need you to redeem the family, Solomon. I need you to clean up this mess. If God's going to keep his promise, if God's going to bless our family, then I need you to fix what I broke. No pressure. And then in verse 5, David loses his mind. He just takes us to crazy town. I wish he would have stopped after verse 4, but he doesn't. And there is something else. You know what Joab, son of Zeruiah, did to me when he murdered my two army commanders, Abner, son of Ner, and Amasa, son of Jether. He pretended that it was an act of war, but it was done in a time of peace, staining his belt and sandals with innocent blood. Do with him what you think best, but don't let him grow old and go to his grave in peace. Some of you are going, did David just tell him to do what I think he just told him to do? And the answer is yes. He just told him to send this guy Joab to take a dirt nap. That's what he told him. It gets worse. He goes on and he says, be kind to the sons of Barzillai of Gilead. Make them permanent guests at your table, for they took care of me when I fled from your brother Absalom. That's a whole other story. We'll get to that in a minute. And remember Shimei, son of Gerah, the man from Bahurim and Benjamin. He cursed me with a terrible curse as I was fleeing to Mahanaim. When he came down to meet me at the Jordan River, I swore by the Lord that I would not kill him, but that oath does not make him innocent. You are a wise man, and you will know how to arrange a bloody death for him. Live well, my son. It's like David has just gone from Denzel Washington to Marlon Brando, all right? Might as well have told him to cut off the head of a horse and stick it in the guy's bed or something. And you're like, David, what are you doing here, man? I mean, David is he's defensive here. He's angry. He's sort of controlling. And he's telling his son to do some things that he shouldn't have done. What I love about the next couple of verses is that it gives us hope that even in the midst of David's bad fathering, God's still in control of all of this, because it says in verse 10 that David died and was buried with his ancestors in the city of David. And David had reigned over Israel for 40 years, 7 of them in Hebron and 33 in Jerusalem. And Solomon became king, and he sat on the throne of David his father, and his kingdom was firmly established, showing us that God's grace and God's ways are bigger than our faults as parents. And I'm really, really thankful for that, aren't you? So I think that when it comes to our responsibility as parents, it's very easy for each and every one of us to kind of fall somewhere along this continuum right here between being overbearing with our kids or being uninvolved. It's very, very easy to fall on this line of the continuum, and we definitely see David doing that. David's words here to his son Solomon shows us that he could have a bit of an overbearing nature, and David, throughout his life, had a history of trying to control things, going all the way back to his interaction with Solomon's mother, Bathsheba, if you know anything at all about that story. And we see this coming out with his kids. And you know, as parents, it's very natural for us to want, especially with our first child, our oldest child, there's a lot of pressure on us to provide for them, to make sure that they're protected, to make sure that maybe they have some experiences that maybe we didn't have growing up. And so what ends up happening is, in an effort to want to protect our kids and provide for our kids and insulate our kids, is that we end up becoming overbearing. We may not even see it. And so this happens whenever maybe our kid doesn't get as much playing time on the ball field until we yell at the coach, or maybe they don't get the grade that we think that they deserve, and so we take it out on the teacher, or they don't live up to our expectations for them, and so we're constantly putting pressure on them, and it creates this weight that our kids were never meant to carry. Many times as parents, it's very easy for us to kind of put our kids and how they're doing at the very center of our value as individuals. And so our affections and our attention gets placed upon our kids. And for all practical purposes, we end up worshiping our kids. And I know that may sound kind of strange, because you're like, well, I've never worshiped my kids. I've never bowed down and sung their praises. But that's not what worship is. Worship is anything that you've centered your affection and your attention upon. And I'll tell you, even at an early age, your kids can feel that. And that is a weight that your kids were never meant to carry. Being overbearing can come out in a variety of different ways. I've got a bunch of examples as a dad, but I'll just share with you one. I asked my son's permission to share this. He's 15. I have to do that now. It used to be that I didn't have to ask his permission to use him as an illustration in sermons, but now I do. All right, so I asked him if I could use this, but he just recently got his driver's permit, so he's trying to log some hours in the car with us to prepare for him turning 16 and getting his license. And so he's been mostly like driving in the car with his mom, and a few weeks ago, the three of us were together, and he said, hey, can I drive home? So I'm like, all right. So I pulled in the parking lot, and so we get around, and I could tell that immediately he was nervous, more nervous than I usually am used to seeing him. And so he gets in the driver's seat, I'm in the passenger seat, Lindsay's in the back seat, and he's taken an inordinate amount of time to adjust his seat and mirrors. Like, we're saying, like, okay, son, like, within this 24-hour period, we need to we need to get home, all right? So immediately I put a little bit of pressure on him to kind of get going, which I could tell just kind of tensed him up a little bit more. So he gets out onto the road and he approaches one of the roundabouts, and there's no cars going around it, and it's a yield sign, and he comes to a complete stop, to which I immediately said, "Son, you don't need to stop, it's a yield." And he goes, "What's a yield?" And right then the car behind us just laid on his horn, which set me off, right? Because you can honk at me, no big deal. You honk at my son, I'm going to just automatically get defensive. And so I rolled down the window, kind of give the guy a dirty look. I just about got into my second fist fight ever, right? And then immediately I'm like rolling out the window like, I hope he doesn't go to our church. And so welcome to my world, all right? So all that it served to do is it just tensed my son up even more, and my wife would tell me later, and modeled for him road rage, which we don't want. So we're heading home. There's a little bit of road construction. There's a stop sign. He doesn't see it. It's sort of hidden behind some cones, and it would have been easy to miss, and he missed it, and he just rolled through it. And I was like, "Son, there was a stop sign right there. You got to pay attention." And he's just shutting down. And so we finally get into the driveway, and he gets out, gives me the keys. He mutters something under his breath, like, "Well, that was the worst drive ever," and goes upstairs, and I'm just kind of like sitting there, and I turn around and look at my wife, and she's doing one of these. And after 19 years of marriage, I know what that means. And she said, "Aaron," she goes, "he wants to impress you so bad, and you just can't see it." She's like, "He was trying so hard to show you that he knows what he's doing, and you were being overbearing, and it was creating a lot of pressure for him." She's like, "You need to go talk to him." She was right. See, that's just one example. I wish I only had one, but one of the real challenges, I think, and some of you can relate to this, like I almost found it to be easier to be a father when my kids were really, really little, and all you had to do was just do things for them. Now, I was more stressed out and tired, but I didn't necessarily have to think so much. I was just like, "Okay, your diaper needs to be changed. Okay, I'm going to change it. We did it. You're dry. I'm a good dad. All right. You're hungry. All right. You want me to feed you? All right. You're full. All right. I'm winning." Okay, so now, like, it's super, super challenging because your kids develop opinions, and sometimes those opinions are different than yours, and they have emotions, and they have feelings, and as a dad, I'm really finding that as they grow older, I'm having to really discern how much should I let go. I can't hold on too long, I can't let go too early, and that requires a great amount of wisdom. So some of us, maybe we want to just kind of follow Mark Twain's advice for parenting. You remember what he said? He said, "When your kids turn 13, put them in a barrel, feed them through the hole. When they turn 16, plug up the hole." And there are moments when I want to put my kids in a barrel, but not because I don't want to be around them, but because I want to protect them. I want them to stay small. I mean, there was a day not so long ago when that 15-year-old boy was looking up at me doing this, and he didn't do that anymore. And if he did, that'd be weird. But but I miss those days. And the thing is that the goal of parenting isn't to keep your kids small and dependent upon you. The goal of parenting is to prepare this individual to be the person that God created for them to be, and to prepare them for everything that life is going to throw at them. And so when we are overbearing, when we try to live vicariously through them, when we try even subconsciously to keep them dependent upon us, we stifle them, we hinder them, we hold them back for who God wants them to be and what he has planned for them. And I don't think that any of us would want this. It's just that sometimes it's a blind spot for us. We've got to ask for some wisdom and some discernment. We've got to ask others to tell us what they see. And so here's just a few wisdom principles. You might want to pull out your phone and take a picture of these or write them down to just kind of spend some time thinking about it. I'll go through them quickly. But first thing is just establish boundaries for your kid, but then let them run inside the boundaries. So give them some boundary lines, but then let them make decisions within it. Be firm yet forgiving. Clarify your expectations for them so they're not guessing, but be a safe person for them to run to whenever they fall. Don't bail them out every time. Maybe the best thing that you can do as a mom or a dad is just let them face the consequences, regardless of how painful it may be for them or you. Model for them what you'd like to see from them. In other words, walk the walk, don't just talk it, and give them the freedom to fail. And a long time ago, Lindsay and I agreed that these four little people growing up in our house are not our kids. We love them. We'll do anything for them. But they're not our kids. They are God's kids that he has placed on loan to us for 18, hopefully no more than 22 years or so. We'll be praying about that. And the way that we raise them will either prepare them for life or will hold them back. So I think for some of us, it's not that overbearing is our issue. Maybe we fall on this other side of the continuum. I know that I have, is to be maybe a little bit checked out or uninvolved in the life of our kids. We see this in the life of David. In fact, these two actually kind of mirror each other, or actually one causes us to overreact to the other side. I think that we see that in David's life, that his inclination to be overbearing, I think, here at the end of his life with Solomon was because there was a time earlier on when he was largely checked out with his kids. You can read all about it in 2 Samuel 13, but I'll go ahead and warn you, it's pretty graphic, it's pretty disturbing, and I'll just keep it PG, but David has a daughter named Tamar, and she has a half-brother, one of David's other sons, named Amnon, and he becomes infatuated with his half-sister, and he ends up forcing himself upon her, and then her brother, Absalom, one of David's other boys, is just thrown into an outrage, largely because David doesn't do anything. And Absalom just goes on a complete tear. He rips the family apart. All of it ends in his eventual death. The whole scenario runs like 5 chapters long. So it's a huge saga in the life of David's family. And David just seems to be checked out. You don't hear much from him. He does not intervene. He just seems to be on the sidelines. And I can't help but wonder why. And I wonder if one of the reasons why is because when he hears what's happened, it maybe strikes a little bit too close to home. And it kind of reminds him of what he had done with Bathsheba all those years ago, because it was very, very similar. And I wonder if David's sitting here thinking to himself, who am I to say anything? Who am I to intervene? My kids know about my past. I've lost all credibility with them. And so he does nothing. And it's ironic and it's tragic that David had all of these incredible victories on the battlefield, and yet he couldn't win at home. And if he had only fought as fiercely and courageously for his kids as he had against that giant named Goliath all those years ago, I can't help but wonder if that would have changed things. And maybe for you right now as a parent, your challenge isn't that you are too involved in the life of your kids. Maybe your challenge is that you're not involved enough. And maybe there's some reasons for this or some excuses. Maybe things are just really, really crazy at work right now. Maybe your job requires you to travel a lot, and you say, well, you know, I'm providing for them. I'm giving them the life that I never had. Maybe you're divorced or separated, and you have a blended family right now, and you don't get to see your kids as often as you would like. Maybe you have this, like, overriding sense of inadequacy due to some of your past failures, and so you feel like it stripped you of any sort of credibility to speak into the life of your children. And so you find yourself being checked out with your kids more than you would like and more than you know that you should. There was a study done several years ago where it revealed 4% of teenage girls in America feel that they could safely approach their fathers to discuss serious problems that they were facing in their lives. In fact, a poll in USA Today indicated that when teens face some sort of a crisis, the first place that they run to for comfort is music. The second thing is their friends. The third is social media. And moms and dads are way on down the list. And you know, we could go, well, you know, teens will be teens, or parents just don't understand, or whatever. And that may be true to a certain extent. But as parents, we need to let our kids know that we are available and that we are approachable, even if there is a period of time where they think it's uncool to do so. You got to say, hey, and the only way to do that, approachability, is spelled this way, T-I-M-E. And it's this idea that I'm going to be available, I'm going to carve out large blocks of time. Life gets busy on a day-to-day basis, and so I'm going to fight to carve out time for my kids so that they know that they are the priority. And so we can't just do parenting in a matter of a few minutes a day. Parenting requires larger blocks of time. Next month is the Indianapolis 500, and I love that race, but one of the things I love the most about the race is watching all the pit crews when the car comes roaring into the pit stops, and you just see this whole synchronized effort where you've got one person that comes in and jacks up the car, and the other one who takes off the wheels and puts on the new ones, and somebody else who tops off the tank and makes adjustments to the wing, and they service the car in like 15 seconds or less, and then it's on its way. And what's so impressive when it comes to the Indianapolis 500 isn't nearly as admirable when it comes to parenting. And I've certainly been guilty of being a pit stop parent. Where it's kind of like, hey, you know, I'm checking in with you. What do you need? You need 20 bucks? Here's 20 bucks. All right, you had lunch today? Or you have lunch? All right, we're good. Hey, anything? How was your day today? Their answer is always good. And I got to press. All right, it was fine. Okay, that's great. Tell me what was good about it. All right, and I got to make sure that I've spent a little bit more time with my kids and not just see them in passing, so that I would never want them to be going through something and they just never said anything to me because they thought that I didn't have the time for them, or that I was too preoccupied or too grumpy or too, it was just too uncomfortable for them to bring it up. The demands and the challenges that are placed upon me around here on a regular basis are pretty heavy at times, and I love it. I love what I do. I hope to do it for a really, really long time. But oftentimes it's easy for me to take some of those challenges home, and I can be preoccupied, so I'm there physically, but I'm not there emotionally or mentally. And I know many of you know what that's like. Many of you have careers that's high demanding, high pressure. And so I thought to myself, you know, if I don't get really intentional about this, then it'll never happen. And so I just kind of wrote out this manifesto for me. This is not what I'm doing perfectly. This is what I am aspiring to do. This is the target for me. And maybe some of you can adapt this to yourselves, maybe make a few tweaks to fit you. But this was my manifesto. I set the spiritual direction in our home. I make it a safe place emotionally through my demeanor and speech. I give the best of my energy, focus, and passion at home, and not just spend it all at work. I pray with and for my kids. I practice what they hear me preach. I will not be some phony preacher who is a totally different guy at home than I am on stage. I regularly evaluate my fathering by asking my wife and kids, how am I doing? And I listen to their feedback without getting defensive. I share what they give me permission to with my group, and I let these men hold me accountable. I decided a long time ago that as a father and a pastor, I had a significant challenge in the sense that I did not want my kids to grow up being bitter preacher's kids who thought that their dad loved the church more than them, or that their dad gave the church the best of his efforts more than he gave to them. And so I decided a long time ago, when I'm at church, I just want to look normal. I want to dress as normal as I can. I don't want to speak in that preacher voice. I just want to be as real as I possibly can be on stage, so that when my kids listen to me preach, they see the same guy on this stage that they see around the kitchen table at home. I want them to know that I really believe this stuff. I want them to know I really believe this stuff, and it's not just an act. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of times where I have to go home and say, hey, I really messed up, didn't I? And I need you to give your dad some grace, because I really messed up there, and I want to learn from it, and I want to grow. It means a ton to me when, in raising our kids around here, oftentimes, if any of you know anything at all about preacher's kids or PKs, and I know some of you are one, and either the PKs like love the church and they love Jesus and they're really well-centered human beings, or they're not. And they're angry and they're bitter. And and some of that is on the pastor or the parents, and some of that's on the church, where the church puts pressure on those kids to know more than they think that they should, or to act a certain way. I want to thank you as a church for not doing that to my kids. This is a great place for us to raise our kids. And all the time I have like adults in this church that know our kids that'll take interest in them and speak words to them that maybe right now I can't, because I'm their dad and it's not maybe necessarily cool for them to hear it from their dad. But you'll speak words of courage and faith and hope into them. When my son went with me to Peru a couple weeks ago, there was a couple leaders here at the church, and there was the directors of Stadium Compassion, and they were constantly like rushing to sit next to Connor at dinner. And they were constantly like asking him questions about school and sports and girls. And hey, what, Connor, what did you think about those home visits? And letting him speak into it. And then they were actually speaking some things into him. Like, hey, Connor, I really noticed you're good at that. Hey, Connor, what do you think God wants to do with you in your life? And I could just see my boy kind of come to life in those moments. When I was growing up, I had two or three friends. Every time I was in their home, their fathers were like speaking words of courage and faith into me. They were like, hey, Aaron, I can tell that you're good. God's gifted you in some things that you're going to take, and God's going to use you in tremendous ways throughout your life. They were calling some things out of me that I didn't even know were there. That's one of the powers of the local church community and being involved. If you have young kids, our kids' ministry is designed to help equip you to be the primary influence in your kids' spiritual growth and development. I want to be really, really clear that our kids' ministry is not you outsourcing their spiritual growth and development to us. That's on you. We're there to equip you to do what God's called you to do. We have 1 hour with your kids every week. You have 168. And so I know that sounds a little intimidating, and so we actually want to come alongside you and give you some confidence to do that. Our kids ministry team develops some great content that's age appropriate for you to use, ideas for you to use in the car with your kids to have a conversation at bedtime, at dinner, just daily conversations where you can run point on pointing your kids to Jesus. And you can check all that out at tpcc.org/parentconnect. So here's where I want to land on this continuum. It's not being overbearing as a mom or a dad. It's not being uninvolved. We want to find ourselves kind of in this region right here as being prayerful and intentional. Now notice I said intentional, not prayerful and perfect. There's no such thing. But prayerful and intentional, where we are on our knees regularly praying for our kids, that we are as intentional as we can be with them, knowing the best things that we should do for their future development. And I like how Andy Stanley says it. He says, you know, your most significant contribution to the kingdom of God may not be anything that you do, but someone that you raise. And I also know right now that maybe for a number of you, this is really painful because maybe you're in the midst of a season with your kids that's challenging, or maybe your kids are grown and gone and you're not very close anymore. And you're like, man, I thought I did the best I could. But man, looking back, I really made some mistakes. And I just wonder if our relationship can be redeemed. I wonder if we can be closer than we are. And I know some of you, that you were really hoping that I wasn't going to read this verse, but I'm going to go ahead and throw it in there. Proverbs 22:6. Start children off on the way they should go, and even when they're old, they will not turn from it. And some of you don't like that verse because you thought you did, but they aren't. I thought we did. We did everything that we could. Or we raised two kids in the same house, and one of them loves Jesus, and one of them is really far from him. I mean, what did we do wrong? And I'm just telling you, you didn't do anything wrong. Right? I mean, they're making their own decisions and their own choices, and you can't control them anyway. They're not robots. But you can be prayerful, and you can be intentional, and that never changes regardless of their age. You stay prayerful, you stay intentional, and you trust that God loves your kids even more than you do, and he's in control. A couple of weeks ago, I was having dinner with one of the directors of Compassion, and he was telling me a story about his daughter. She's in her mid-20s now, and she's happily married, but he said, you know, Aaron, when she was 11 years old, which really got my attention because I have an 11-year-old daughter, he said, we were at a Compassion event where all the packets, you know, were out with the kids that you could sponsor, very similar to what we did on Easter weekend. And he said, our family already sponsored two or three kids, but my 11-year-old daughter came up to me with a packet, and she said, Daddy, I want to sponsor this little girl. And he's like, honey, we can't do that. We're already sponsoring kids as a family. And she said, well, no. She goes, but this one's for me. Like, I want to sponsor. And he said, honey, you don't have a job. And I know what'll happen is that after, you know, a couple months, it'll fall on us to actually fulfill this commitment that you're making. And man, she just wouldn't have it. She's like, I want to sponsor this little girl. So finally, he let her do it, and they filled out all the information, and she stayed true to her word. She got babysitting jobs, and she got jobs throughout high school at fast food restaurants, and she sponsored this little girl all the way through high school and college. Well, he said, Aaron, between the ages of 16 and 19 for her was some really challenging years. He said she started hanging out with the wrong crowd. She started dating a boy that wasn't a very good influence on her. She wore makeup and clothes that we didn't approve of. Every one of our conversations usually ended in a screaming match, and that is if she would even talk to us. And he said, I honestly got to tell you, like, there were days, like, she would question her belief in God. She wouldn't go with us to church. He said her mother and I were really fearful. We just did not know what was going to happen. It was 50-50. Well, she comes through all of that. She graduates from college, meets a great Christian guy. They're engaged to be married, and he and her go on this dinner date. And she has a shoebox with her, and she scoots it across the table to her father. She said, Dad, I want you to pull out a few of those letters, and I just want you to read them. And he said, who are they from? And she said, well, this is correspondence between me and my sponsored girl all those years, and these are a few of the letters that she wrote me. And so he pulls out the letters, and he begins to read. And about three or four letters in, he realizes what's happening is that during that phase of time between 16 and 19, when his daughter was a prodigal, when she was off not talking to them, she was actually confiding in, through letters, with this girl that she was sponsoring in another country. And she was airing out all of her questions about God. She was airing out all of the things that she was tempted to do with her boyfriend. She was talking about how her parents don't understand, how she was so upset with them. And he said, I start reading these letters back from this girl, and tears form into my eyes because she was encouraging her to stay faithful to God, to make wise decisions, to continue to love and trust us as parents. And he said, it dawned on me what was happening is that during those years, when our daughter wasn't talking to us, that God was using a sponsor girl living in poverty on the other side of the world to disciple my little girl's heart back to him. That's the kind of big God that we serve. And that's the kind of big God, regardless of your circumstances right now, that's in control. And I know it's hard. And I know it's painful. And I know maybe you feel like you're in way over your head. Would you let God father you? God that would send his only son so that he might be reconciled with you. And would you just trust that he says, listen, your job is not to make your kids' decisions for them. Your job is not to control them. But as a parent, it is to simply be the mediator in between, to be prayerful and intentional. And he's got it. He's got it. Let's pray together. Father, we come to you right now. Thank you for the blessing of being a parent. Thank you if our parents were a blessing to us. God, I specifically just want to lift up those individuals who so desperately want to be parents, but it hasn't happened for them yet. And I pray that your spirit would comfort them right now. And God, I pray for the parents that maybe they're estranged with their kids, or maybe somebody's here today and things are not going well with their parents. There's so much tension in this really powerful relationship, and God, we're going to have to fight for it. We ask that you would do what only you can do and we cannot. And so God, we're just exhausted, we're at the end of ourselves, and so we just come to you with empty hands. We just say, God, here's my messy situation. Could you take and do something with that? Could you work a miracle? Could you redeem it? God, I pray that we would make, as men, women, and kids, we would make some courageous decisions today. Decisions that might require some discomfort. Decisions that would require extra energy when it would be far easier to fight the other person rather than fight for them. Meet us in this place. Do a work that only you can do as we respond to you now. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.